Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, Equal Pay Day, a day established to highlight the pay gap between men and women, gained some added attention with historic recent gains in U.S. women's hockey and soccer. But those gains are unlikely to change the outcome of a Pew Research Center analysis that found women earned 83 cents for every dollar earned by men in 2015. Coming up, we'll hear from sports icon Billie Jean King, who has devoted much of her fame to the issue of pay equity for women in sports. Joining us now is CEO of Gender EQA, a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity, Julie Graber. Welcome back, Julie.
Thanks, Ann.
Also by phone, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Women's Policy Research in D.C., Julie Anderson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. My pleasure.
The pay gap has been declining since 1980. What do we know, Julie Anderson, about how and why that has declined? Do we know?
Yeah, what we know is that over time, men's wages have been stagnant for a number of decades. Of course, when women weren't really in the labor force much at all, they first came in and got very low pay. That closed rapidly for a time, but now that progress is really stalling. So women's wages are going up slowly, but when we project out, it's going to be a very long time until we see that at the current rate of progress, the pay would be equal.
Right. Julie Graber, I read something like a 16-year-old starting work today would not, when she retires at the age of 65, have pay equity, all things being equal.
That's correct. In fact, it starts out as maybe a small number, and the wage gap usually grows as women's careers advance. So I just saw an article that predicted it would be the 23rd century before we close the pay gap. So,
which is crazy.
Yeah.
And the idea that probably if it's a function of men's wages stagnating, that women have made these gains, that's not good either.
No. Uh-uh. No. And the progress is very slow.
Yeah.
Exactly. And in some of the states that we see the wage gap would close the quickest, it's because men's earnings are so low, the bar is so low, that even when women catch up, that doesn't mean that they have sort of family-sustaining wages in their area, in their state.
Yeah, where the wage gaps are least is in the lower-paying jobs.
Often, yes. Yeah. Yes.
We always hear a lot of news when organizations such as women's hockey and soccer make strides toward equality, but they don't change the equation much, right, Julie Anderson?
Right. I mean, I think the good thing is when we hear of a celebrity drawing attention to this, realizing that, you know, in the case of Jennifer Lawrence, she had many more awards than her co-stars and yet realized she had been paid significantly less.
Only because of the hack on Sony.
Exactly. Yeah. Or we realize that the women's soccer team, who is sort of the best in the world, is being underpaid. I think the good thing is that, of course, is not the case for many women who are toiling at two or three jobs and are not earning anywhere near that level. But it always brings attention back to the issue and, I think, to the policies that might be able to help people who are not quite so elite.
Let's be clear, too, Julie Graber. We're talking about gender pay gap in the U.S., right? We're not talking about other countries. What's the score in other, you know, comparable countries?
Julie Anderson may know better than I do. I'm not really familiar with data in other countries. Actually, you know, I just saw an article about Canada. I don't think it really is different in other countries.
Okay.
Canada, I know, has a similar challenge in terms of its pay gap. I think traditionally around the world, women are generally paid less for the work they do.
Julie Anderson?
Yes, I would second that. Yes, I think that's true.
What kind of, Julie, your company, Julie Graber, your company works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity. What's the interest in this? What are you finding in your business?
You know, I think that many organizations are trying to take a good look at this issue and address it. But I think what happens very often is that there are certain biases about what we ought to be paying women for their work and what things justify paying them less that get in the way. You see research or news announcements from tech companies about how they've achieved pay equity. I forget who heard it said it last week, but it's like, you know, I think if I dug into their data and I actually looked at, you know, what's going on in terms of what are the opportunities women are getting to advance into higher paying jobs, I think when you start to really pick it apart, most organizations are still falling very short.
Julie Anderson, what is the function of the trend for women to drop out of the workforce for different periods of time, whether it's to take care of children, take care of aging parents, that kind of a thing? That's a thing, right?
That's absolutely a thing. And I think it is in the absence of the kind of paid leave policies that all other advanced countries have, the United States being the only country without paid family and medical leave. And so I think families are economically logical entities. And so if someone is earning less and one person has to cut back hours or step out entirely to care for a child or to care for a relative, it makes sense that that would be the woman if she is the lower earning, which is likely. And that just has sort of lifelong consequences in terms of earnings, promotion opportunities, and even things like retirement. We see high levels of poverty among elderly women. Well, if they had to step back and sort of never recovered in the labor market, that has ripple effects throughout their life.
Right. Yeah, Julie Graber.
But I think it's important to point out that those family obligations aren't necessarily well, let me step back and say the reality is the pay gap starts at the very first job, typically well before women are worrying about children, parents, well before the time that they have significant caregiver responsibilities. So to suggest that that is one of the reasons that we have the pay gap and that it justifies it in some way, I think it is misrepresentative of what's really taking place.
It just exacerbates mm-hmm. the trend.
Yes.
It doesn't have that much of an effect. You know, as long as you've raised that issue now, I'm kind of fascinated by what's going on in Pennsylvania. The lawmakers there are considering a bill that would forbid municipalities from enacting measures to address pay inequity. Are there such efforts to address pay inequity that might be vulnerable if this catches on? I mean, is this, Julie Anderson, do you know if Pennsylvania is an outlier on this, where they would prohibit municipalities from trying to change the scorecard?
I think they are, yeah. What we're seeing is we get interest from counties, sometimes sort of cities or counties who are interested in modeling if they did implement a certain paid leave policy. You know, they just need somebody to run the numbers. What if we allow 8 weeks at 50% reimbursement and so on? What would be the cost to implement that plan? What percentage of employees would actually use that sort of leave? And so, yeah, that preemptive strike is not something I've really heard of, but I think it's in response to a law in Massachusetts that had an interesting clause that prohibits employers from asking about previous salary history.
Yeah, in Philadelphia, they just had a law go into effect along the same score. What is the effect of the salary history issue?
Well, the thing is, if a woman just wants, as Julie Graber pointed out, from very early in their work life, there's already a wage gap. So if just once a woman allows herself to be underpaid or undervalued or isn't aware that she is, in fact, underpaid, then if the salary at a new job is based on that underpayment at a previous job, that just creeps in forever. If instead the burden is on an employer to decide, here is a position and what it is worth, no matter the qualities of the person who shows up to do the job, then that can have a leveling effect, and it doesn't allow that sort of low pay to follow you throughout your career.
A lot of it's self-reporting anyways, and some people say, well, just lie, but women will tend not to lie about something like that either. Right, Julie Graber?
Well, and sometimes they can get that information from a previous employer.
Can they? I mean, is that legal?
It has been in the past. I mean, people have done it in the past. I don't know if it's legal or not, but again, they'll take what information they can get and move forward with it.
Julie Anderson, to what extent does the pay gap begin at the top? Already we know that men disproportionately lead, well, at least around in this region, lead three quarters of the universities, the vast majority of companies, and in most boardrooms. Are the women who compete in those circles also earning less?
Yes. I mean, we look at every year, we look at all the occupations we can that have enough men and women in them to have earnings data. And in every single occupation, if you compare men and women doing the same occupation, in all except for four, men out-earn women. So it is not that women who are in sort of higher status, higher earning jobs are not susceptible to that. That follows people who are, you know, CEOs, doctors, lawyers, you know, you name it. So it's part of the labor market at all points.
Well, and I can say that we just finished up doing the Central High Leadership Census, which looks at women on boards of public companies here. We also look at executive officers. We look at top compensated execs. And there are only, out of the 31 companies we have headquartered here, there are only 15 women who are among the top compensated executives in those companies. It's about 9 or 10% of the total.
15 individuals.
15 individual women who are part of the top compensated pool of executives.
And what is this an issue that you address, Julie Graber, when you talk to companies about equity? And I mean, do you talk about pay specifically?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not just about where women are having the opportunity to advance. It's whether they're being paid fairly for the work that they do.
Is the gap largely, are they conscious of it? Are they unconscious of it? Are they like, well, that's, we're just paying them what we can pay them?
I think in most cases they're unconscious of it unless they... You know, it takes a company that's really interested in looking at diversity and inclusion metrics, which include not only women and minorities and the positions that they hold. And frankly, a lot of times they'll look at those numbers, but they won't look at the pay inequity that they have in their organization. So, again, and you almost have to do it in combination because, as I said before, until you look at, you know, are women and having the opportunity to advance is one question. Whether they're being paid fairly is a second question. And the combination of it is, are they having the opportunity to advance into jobs where they'll be paid well?
And Julie Anderson, do we know if it matters for down the food chain if there are more women at the top or more women near the top in the boardrooms, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, I think we find it's good for companies, but it's also good in that I think some of the things, especially if we think about women perhaps in politics, is if you just don't imagine yourself in a role, you may not aspire to it. If your mental image is always of a man, then you don't have the vision, you don't have the networks that you need to go to those positions. What we find is women who rise up through the ranks create a pathway and help mentor those who follow behind them. I think when mentoring is not a real specific formalized process, people tend to gravitate to those who are like them. I don't think that's a malicious thing. I think it's just a tendency. But if it's women who are rising up, then they will bring along others.
Well, and I think you see it in the research somewhat mixed, but where I've really seen the impact is when you have a woman in the CEO spot. Then you have more women at the executive level, and you have more women at the top compensated level in the organization. And I suspect that follows through more fully throughout the organization.
We are talking about pay equity in the United States and beyond. You just heard from Julie Graber. She's CEO of Gender EQA. It's a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity. Also with us by phone, Julie Anderson, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Coming up later in the hour, Billie G. King will join us. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about the gender pay gap in the U.S. Women are paid 83 cents for every dollar men are paid in the workplace. Coming up, we'll hear from sports icon Billie Jean King, who has devoted much of her fame to the issue of pay equity for women in sports. Still with us is CEO of Gender EQA, a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equality, or gender equity, I should say, Julie Graber. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be here.
And by phone, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C., Julie Anderson. Thanks again, Julie, for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
President Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Law in 1963. At the time, women earned 59% of men's wages. What difference did a law like that even matter, Julie Anderson? Did it?
It absolutely mattered. I think what we find is that it's a bit outdated and enforcement is not robust. So, you know, every year on Equal Pay Day, you referred to that, that happened last week, we introduced the Paycheck Fairness Act, which sort of remedies some of the things that the Equal Pay Act did not effectively address.
Like what?
Well, so one of them is more data has to be reported on wages. So currently, there isn't that much requirement for businesses to report wage by gender, by race and ethnicity. And so companies may not be aware, and certainly individual employees may not be aware, that they are not being paid fairly based compared to a comparable worker in their place. And second, it shifts the burden of proof that there is wage discrepancy or discrimination onto the employer and not onto the employee. I mean, the threshold before was nearly impossible for an individual to have enough information to prove that gender was the basis of that wage discrimination. And so that shift, I think, should be pretty empowering were it to pass.
So it's kind of a paper tiger, Julie Graber? Didn't really...
Well, without... I think it... I mean, it may not have had... I mean, certainly didn't have the impact it was supposed to have, but it at least put a line in the sand and made it really, both in the minds of men and women, created the question about women's pay and what was fair and what was equal.
The issue of being able to put the burden of proof on the employer and reporting, occurred to me. When I was watching that, I think it's an Amazon original, Good Girls Revolt. Are you familiar with that, Julie Anderson? It was about the...
I haven't seen the show. Yeah.
Yeah, it was about the lawsuit that was filed against, you know, against a magazine in New York at the time. It's based... It's a fictional account of it, but it's very strongly rooted in it. And in one scene, one of the women had to steal the records in order to show the records.
Right. Right, exactly. You just don't have access to the type of information that would be the basis for proving that it is gender and not some other factor.
How does the public sector stack up in all of this? Wages are public, for one thing, right?
Yes. Wages are public in things like government jobs or the military, where the wage structure is set. And so people understand the exact criteria for hiring somebody, for promotions, and what the associated wages are, the gap is smaller. So that kind of transparency does have the result of narrowing the wage gap.
When we talk about all workers, women make 83 cents for every dollar earned by men, according to the Pew Research I cited earlier. But the wage gap is smaller when we consider full-time year-round workers only, and even smaller for women ages 25 to 34. What do those differences tell us? Julie Graber?
Well, I think certainly the age issue is a function of the number of young women who are getting college degrees. And so I think that has had an impact on the gap in that particular range. But the gap still exists. And as we talked about earlier, it may be smaller there, but for most women, it continues to grow as their career advances. Actually, I think the numbers you're looking at are for full-time work.
Okay.
If you look at part-time work, if you look at factoring in part-time work as part of the larger picture, the wage gap is even larger for men and women. So And very often what you find is because of every other demand on women's lives, they end up in part-time jobs when they'd rather really have one full-time. But very often employers avoid that because of the other costs associated with a full-time employee.
Benefits, so, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, that type of thing. So, you know, there's so many things that factor into it.
Julie Anderson, what about the some jobs have larger pay gaps than others? What are the best jobs to have for women if you're interested in equity?
I think that seems like a difficult question, but what I would say is there is this new attention on middle skill jobs. And what we mean by those are jobs that require some sort of education or training after high school, but not necessarily a four-year degree. I think we're leaving out a huge swath of the population who are not prepared or do not have the resources to go on to get that bachelor's degree. But what we find is there are lots of women in middle school skill jobs, but they're pooled at the lower paying end of those jobs. And so we just have to sort of break this idea that women keep going into jobs that are dominated by women and tend to be lower paying. If we could move more women into some higher paying middle skills jobs, that probably could be on a large enough scale to really make a dent in the wage gap.
Some women it's been suggested that women just aren't socialized to negotiate and to get what they deserve. Julie Graber, what about that?
You know, one of my hot buttons, the fact that women don't ask and therefore it's their own fault they don't get more money. You're right. We socialize women to take care of other people. And the idea that we, you know, all we have to do is teach them how to negotiate and they'll have fair wages. What women find is when they do negotiate, there's backlash. And they very often aren't as successful as men are in negotiating their salary. As far as I'm concerned, you know, we need women to be at the table as their authentic selves. We won't reap the benefits of having them there if they have to act like men to get there. And so, you know, I really would like to see employers eliminate negotiation completely. You know, can't you tell how much you ought to be paying someone based on what they contribute and what their experience is? The fact that you would pay one person a couple thousand more because they asked for it doesn't seem like a real sound business decision to me.
Julie Graber, thank you so much for joining us. I always appreciate your insights on this topic.
I appreciate being here. It's always fun.
Julie Graber, CEO of Gender EQA. That's a firm that works with businesses and organizations to develop and promote gender equity. Also, Julie Anderson, thanks so much for your time and insights.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Julie Anderson is a senior research associate at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Coming up, Billie Jean King joins us. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. That's a cut, of course, from Elton John's number one hit, Philadelphia Freedom, written for the iconic Billie Jean King. Back in 1961, Billie Jean King would just begin to capture national and international attention with her first of a record 20 Wimbledon titles. She went on to win 39 Grand Slam singles, doubles, and mixed doubles during her career. But the real fame game changer, I guess, occurred in 1973 when she defeated Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes on the tennis court. A year later, she co-founded the Professional Tennis League, World Team Tennis, and the Women's Sports Foundation. That's an organization devoted to advancing the lives of girls and women through sports and physical activity. For her work on behalf of social justice and her accomplishments in sports, President Obama awarded Billie Jean King the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2009. A movie about the 1973 Battle of the Sexes event starring Emma Stone and Steve Carell is set for release in September. And Billie Jean joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Ann. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for that big buildup. I hope I live up to that buildup.
Well, actually, I was going to say something like, and I had to cut half of the intro out because there's just too much to say about Billie Jean King, so we're even. You were the first female athlete in any sport to earn more than $100,000 in a single season back in 1971. Which I was surprised to read about, but some people might think that maybe the pay equity wasn't as much of an issue for you personally, and I was wondering what sensitized you to the issue.
Oh, that happened early in life when all the boys were getting so much attention, just even from coaches, and then also we all were basically getting the same as amateurs, except the boys, the men, got more money under the table than we did, and that was all the players knew it. For instance, even in the amateur days when Fred Stallie and Roy Emerson came to play on the grass court circuit during the summer, they were getting $1,000 each plus, and that was huge. That was like, oh, that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
The real issue was getting our sport from amateurism to getting it open to every pro, every player, if you're good enough to play, and that happened in 1968. And Rod, he and I both won Wimbledon that year, and Rod got a 2,000-pound check. And I got a 750-pound check, and I'm like, what? I'm like, really? Why didn't I get the same? I got the same. The place is packed when we're playing. And so that's where that started. We got started wrong. Sometimes how you start is how you finish.
Yeah.
So I said to myself, first of all, just getting professional tennis was really difficult. And, of course, after 68, I was trying to get the women and men to be one association or one union. We had to call ourselves an association because we're a contract. People, so individual contracts. So we weren't like working at a company or anything under one umbrella. So the men didn't want to have anything to do with us, and these were my friends, I thought, and they still are my friends today, but it was a very tough, lonely time. And finally, there was nine of us that signed a $1 contract in 1970, and that was the birth of women's professional tennis. And we signed this contract with Gladys Hellman, who was the editor of World Tennis, which was the biggest tennis magazine at the time. She went on to sell it to CBS, and then it went away, so it's not around anymore. But she was a big deal and a great writer. And so we signed a $1 contract with her and in Houston at the Houston Racquet Club. And looking back, we took a lot of it took a lot of courage on the nine of us to do that because we didn't know if we ever get to play in tournaments again, like Wimbledon and the U.S.
Why didn't they want you to professionalize?
We were basically told we weren't going to be able to because they didn't want us to have a tour. I'd asked the USTA to get a tour for us because I could see that the men, my former husband told us when tennis went open or pro, that the men would try to get rid of us. And what happened is men owned tournaments, so they were just starting to drop the women's events. So we could see the writing on the wall, and, of course, Larry had warned me. I'm thankful that he warned me because it was happening very rapidly, and we had to do something. The men didn't want to do anything with us, so I thought, oh, boy. You know, we started talking among ourselves, and I said, we're just going to have to go to Plan B and do it ourselves. And so that's what we did, and that's why we're called the Original Nine, because that is the birth of women's professional tennis, the way you know it today. When you hear the WTA Tour, the nine of us signing that $1 contract was major. And then in 73, founded the Women's Tennis Association. That's when we got everybody together under one umbrella because for a couple of years we had two tours and we were divided. You had Chris Evert with Margaret Court and all those players, and you had the Virginia Slims with Rosa Gonzalez, Ann Jones, Francoise Dewar, and all that. So finally we came together in 73. That was a major, major happening to get us all together, and now you hear about the WTA Tour.
Well, now it's a force of nature. I mean, it's huge. Women's tennis is gigantic.
Well, we're very fortunate because we got started right. We got the money behind the sport quickly, and that made a huge difference, that people believed in us and the money to back it up. Because you can have all the belief system you want, but if you don't have the money, it doesn't happen. So money really does speak loudly. you learn that. I was a small businesswoman by then because Larry and I and some others owned tournaments. We started to, when we started the Virginia Swim Series in 1971, we owned tournaments. We didn't have any money, but we owned them and we took a high risk. And my if we lost money, my prize money would go right into paying the bills. So it was a lot of pressure on both sides as a owner and also playing. So I learned a lot, though, about business, and I've continued to be a small businesswoman. Of course, we started World Team Tennis in 74, and so these are the things that happen. So I think I understand the business side as well as the playing side.
What difference do you think it makes that, you know, tennis, all things being equal, is an individual sport versus these team sports like the U.S. women's hockey and soccer?
What do I think that's a difference?
Yeah, a difference in terms of organizing and being able to get these kinds.
Different. It's different, but it's very similar.
Okay.
Because in the 90s, Julie Foudy, who was the heart and soul and the captain of the soccer team, would come to the Women's Sports Foundation dinner every year. And so for probably 4 years or 5 years, we had breakfast the next morning, and she would talk about her woes with what was going on, and I thought, this is just another repeat of the late 60s and early 70s for us. It was exactly the same challenges, okay, almost. So we talked a lot, and I kept saying, you have to get some leverage, and you need to. The only way you're going to have leverage is if you, first of all, you go to the people, and you do it quietly as much as you can. You do everything you can quietly and with diplomacy behind the scenes. But if that doesn't work, then you have to go to the media. And of course, social media was just getting going for Julie and those guys in the late 90s. And we didn't have social media, so we depended on the traditional media totally to get our story out. So it was slightly starting to shift, but basically they're on the same problem. So we talked about it, and I said, you have to get the next generation of really superstars and the young ones if you're going to make this happen. Because they'll just think you guys are old and they won't worry about you and they'll worry about the next generation. So you've got to get the next generation on board, and that's how they started to leverage and improve their contracts. But it was tough because if you start to say we won't play in the Olympics, we won't play in a national championship, that's when they don't like it. They want to, you know, the U.S. wants to be represented. And so the local people, you know, the national organizations or federations or confederations don't like it. So they really have to, that's what they have to do. But Julie is still, you know, she's doing ESPN now. I wanted her to try to be president of the United States because I thought she had the personality and the smarts. She's really smart. She could have gone to medical school at Stanford. I mean, she's just really smart. And she was the heart and soul of that soccer team. And now you're hearing again about the soccer, you know, a decade later or even more. And then we talked, my partner and I, Lana and I, just talked to Megan, what's her last name, on the ice hockey team.
U.S. Women's Hockey, yeah.
Yeah, and we talked with her, and, you know, just listening, it's the same story, different sport, okay? It's amazing. And there's little nuances of difference, but not really, not the essence. And the challenges are, it's just, you know, there's very few women in the system. And, you know, you look at FIFA. I went and spoke in front of FIFA a couple of years ago and trying to help the women. And they give like 1/20th or 1/10th of the money that they get to send it back out to countries to develop the sport. Very little is going to women. So, but yet that's their opportunity to really grow compared to the men. The men are probably going to flatten out a little. If they go to newer, more, you know, like African countries and more, it'll go up for the men. But the real opportunity of growth as a business is the girls and the women. And they still resist because of the old boy network, what they're used to. But that's where their opportunities are. And they're starting to grasp it a little, but to change people when you have every confederation, some of the confederations with FIFA don't have any women in them.
Right.
Or maybe one as a token. That is not going to work. Just like we know in a boardroom, unless there's three women, nothing you don't have any sense of change or influence. So, and everyone does have influence, but there's the numbers game is important. Like, we need more women in C-suites. We need all these things. And it is so difficult, even with the knowledge that your company will do better at the bottom line. They can prove it now. So, you know, they've done enough data on it. They can prove it. They don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Stephanie Johnson at the University of Colorado studied this, and that's what she explained it. I have a Billie Jean King leadership initiative that Ivana and I started, and we had a men's conference. And I got that way, I was able to get a mixed crowd. We were able to get a mixed crowd. I said, we only get women. This is a problem for both. This is not just a women's problem. This is a men's problem as well. And we have to, so I said, let's try a men's conference. And guess what we had? We had a mixed crowd for the first time, and that's what I wanted. I wanted men and women in the same room talking about these issues, listening to each other, and talk. So anyway, we had a great symposium. And the men were all lit up because it's about them. And the women were great, and they all got into it. And it was really enlightening. But Dr. Stephanie Johnson said, we have all this data now, and guess what? No one wants to believe it. So it's still an emotional thing with people, not a factual, rational thing. So this is a real challenge culturally.
Billie Jean King is with me. She will be in an event coming up on May 4th, the Keyholder 2017, Changing the Game, sponsored by the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information about that.
I hope it's packed. I want it packed. We're going to rock.
They usually pack them in.
And it's in the theater, I think.
Yeah, so, it's a great event. Yeah. The Ohio Theater.
My God, I love theaters. Do you know why? The acoustics are so fantastic.
It's a beautiful theater. If you've never been in it before, it's
fabulous. No, I haven't been in it. I'm really looking forward to it. And I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be.
You know, we've got a lot of people behind it. I mean, I've been reading what's going on and checking in. And, you know, the American Electric Power and the Big Lots Foundation's helping as sponsors. And, you know, without sponsorship, getting back to that's the reason I was able to get equal prize money at the Open.
Mm-hmm.
U.S. Open in 72. Without sponsors, you don't make it. And we wanted equal prize money in the majors, right? So
yeah.
We went to the U.S. Open first in 1972, and it's because I took something to the table that makes a difference. You have to figure out. You can't just keep asking, "What can you give?" And you know, if your blood, sweat, and tears, sometimes it's money, sometimes it's. You got to figure it out how to win. You know, what's the goal, and then how do we get there? It's a lot of work.
You mentioned it was lonely work at the time when you were, one of the nine who helped bring about the Virginia Slims Tour and the Women's Tennis Association. There was a lot of support this time for the U.S. women's hockey team when they threatened to strike the players' unions of the NHL, the National Women's Hockey League, the NBA, NFL, and Major League Baseball spoke out. That must matter a lot.
It does when you can have a lot of help. We even tweeted it and tried to help them and Team Tennis and all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yes, it really helps when you have public opinion. We didn't have that at the time as much as we were young. It was a young time. It was the height of the women's movement, though,
yeah.
Which was helpful, I think, psychologically. Or if you had people who hated it, then it hurt you. So you had to try to analyze a little bit, who am I talking to? What, do they have a daughter? Do they have a good marriage? If they're married, you know, like mm-hmm. You had to really try to analyze each person by person because relationships are really important. And I just think it's fantastic what the Women's Fund of Central Ohio are doing.
Hasn't it professionalizing women's sports and seeking that equity when it comes to pay, hasn't it been good for the business?
Well, because I think we wanted it for the message, not just the money, although mm-hmm. We wanted the money because money is important. But we still don't make as much as the men because of the tours. On the ATP tour, they have more money than the WTA, but the majors we got to do equal, which I thought was an amazing feat. And Venus Williams was important to that as a current player at the time in the, you know, during the middle 2000, because it took us until 2007 to get it, all four majors. And you remember, we got the U.S. Open in 1973 mm-hmm. To do it. So it was a long haul. And the Australian went back and forth all the time. That's a whole other story on its own. But
Well how do other countries stack up?
I know personally, it was not just about the money, which I want the money. Money is so important for women to have. You know, like, we don't get 100. White women get 80 cents, I guess.
83 cents, yeah.
you know, African-American women are like 64%, you know, Hispanic or Latinas are at 50, I think 54% is pathetic. When I played Bobby Riggs, I think it was at 59 cents for white women.
So right.
It's not. And then you look at Japan, where it's 30% for women. It's just ridiculous. I mean, they're slaves. And I know that because we're the first professional athletes to ever go, women professional athletes to ever go to Japan in 1971. And we went twice a year I think I went at least 10 years. And it was fantastic. I loved it. But the women would talk to me in secret, basically, that telling me how horrible their life was. It was just terrible. And they had no chance in corporate Japanese. Japan.
Well, now it's a world corporate.
Yeah, totally. It totally is. But we have, it's going to take another 170 years, according to the latest study. So,
right.
We have to change that. We can do this.
You know, in a recent ESPN article, you recalled the struggles of forming the Women's Tennis Association in 1973, and you talked about a turning point when a young woman worried that if women lost that battle, that they would lose everything. How did that become a turning point?
I don't remember that so much. I remember that more earlier.
Okay.
In 1970. They just questioned. You know, it's so much easier to stay where you're known. You know what you know?
Yeah.
So it's not any good. It's safe to some people. I mean, I just kept arguing in general at the WTA. Well, yes, you're right about the WTA. And then also before with the Original Nine and Rosie Casals and Nancy Ritchie. And people won't even know these women's names, but we're all together. We always stay in touch and we have reunions and we're all still alive. Which is exciting. The WTA is starting to do a lot. I think before we get out of here, they want to get us on tape and talk to us about how things were back then. But a lot of people, they think if you just stay the same, that at least you know it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very frightening thought that things might not be as good as you think you have it now. But I felt like we had nothing to lose. I kept saying, I don't think we have anything to lose. Buckus to lose. It's like, I couldn't believe, we're just afraid. And mm-hmm. I understand, I get afraid, but I think it's really important to really think it through and to face our fears and face my fears. And one of my fears is public speaking, so that's another reason I do these speeches. Makes myself get up there and have to deal. And I make myself do it because it's good for me. And I always, you know, also I keep learning from others. And I think the audience is, I mean, just talking with you today, I'm learning. And I was listening before I came on a little bit, listening
mm-hmm.
to the women you had on
mm-hmm.
About women in the workplace and negotiations. Thought it was very interesting.
What do you think about that?
I think they both had a lot to say. I think that one of the reasons I want girls in sports is they learn to, first of all, men invented these sports. And I think it's really most of the time. And I think it's very important for women to understand the culture that they created for us, for both of us, for both men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it helps if you're in sports, and I'm not talking about being any good. I'm talking about just experiencing the culture.
Mm-hmm.
It teaches you to navigate the culture, the business culture particularly, of our country. And I think that helps. I think it gives you more confidence. I think it helps you lead. I think it helps you know how to support better. I think you understand when a guy's talking what he's really saying. You can read between the lines better. You know what to say and how to say it better, because a lot of times I've been in business meetings where women say things and I'm like, oh my God, that's not going to go over at all. These guys are going to go crazy. The men. Oh, why do I recognize that at all? I've been in sports all my life. I've been around men all my life. I understand, you know, how their nuances and how they talk. And that is very important. No matter who's the leader. If you have a woman leader, I think it's important to understand her. And I think it's understand your boss. And usually, a lot of times, it depends on what you're in. what field of endeavor you're in, but understanding others is a huge part, you know, and also always making the other person look good is important. Like saving face, they talk about in Japan, for instance, or Asia. You always try to make them look good no matter what. Now, if you can't, that's not good, but I never try to put somebody under the bus. Because what good does that do? But I will fight for the right thing, and I'll go to these people and talk to them privately. If worse comes to worse, you might have to mention their name because people know who they are by their rank.
Yeah.
So it's difficult. But I think I think it's important about negotiations that I agree somewhat with. You shouldn't have to. I don't know if you know about Mark Benioff, Salesforce, but he's a great – he had two women who came to him. I think it was Cindy and Leia, I think, or someone, came to him and said – I know you were talking, okay, Mark, I know you're talking about us having equality, but we really don't. He says, what? We don't? She says, we're close, but we don't. He says, let me look at the payroll. Let me look at everything. And he did, and overnight he said, that's changing, and it cost him some millions of dollars, but he did it. You cannot believe that environment at that company, how happy they are. They got voted number one in volunteerism. If you're around the young people there, you know they are a force, and they dream big there. And everyone knows it's equal pay for equal work, and you cannot believe the energy that creates. Because no one's having to find out, what are you making? You know, they're focused on the task at hand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's amazing.
There's a movie coming out in September.
Yes.
About the Battle of the Sexes. And
it's coming out September 22nd.
22nd, right around the anniversary of the 1973 event itself.
Yeah, Fox Searchlight wanted that, so that's
yeah.
why it is.
Well, it's incredibly cast with Steve Carell and Emma Stone, thank you. There's so many Emmas out there.
I was forgetting words when we're talking.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I get that, totally.
When I come to Ohio and have to get up there, I'm like, oh, really? You're going to talk like this? I hope not. It's like, really?
No, you're great. But what do you think about, first of all, the Battle of the Sexes, we only have a few minutes left, but what did your relationship end up being with Bobby Riggs?
I didn't know him that well before the match, but after the match, we always stayed in touch. And, I beat him because I respected him, and he's one of my heroes. Because, I love history. I absolutely love history. So I knew all the champions of the past. And I knew he'd won the Triple Crown at Wimbledon in 1939. I knew that his mixed doubles partner was Alice Marble because she had taught me. I got lucky to meet her, and she helped me for 3 months. And, I knew all that history. I knew that Eleanor Tennant was his teacher. I knew all that stuff about him. And I don't think he knew much about me, but I knew a lot about him. And I think that helped me beat him. But we stayed in touch until, in fact, I talked to him the night before he passed away. I wanted to go see him the week earlier, and he wouldn't let me. Mm-hmm. And so I did talk to him, and he finally said, because I kept telling him in 73, Bobby, this is about history. This is about making a difference. This isn't about money for me. And I will never play you again. If I lose, I will never play you again. If I win, I'll never play you again. And he's like, what? Well, we make so much money. I said, no. And he had already planned it. If he beat me, they'd already had the plan going that he would ask Chris Everett, and they'd probably do a million-dollar match, winner take all, because ours was $100,000,
uh-huh.
winner take all. So he had a whole roadmap. He and Parencio, who is a wonderful man, Jerry Parencio, who promoted the match, and he promoted Ollie Frazier fight. He's amazing. He never wants anybody to even know who he is, but he's a great guy. And so he had it all. He had a roadmap plan for Bobby, how he was going to do that, and then he'd be a touring pro in Vegas, and he would, they had everything planned. And by me beating Bobby, it just put the kibosh on their roadmap afterwards. So, some people said, oh, that wasn't real, and then there was some betting. I said, yeah, right. Talk to Lorne Kuehl, who was his coach. Best friend, talked to Jerry Parencio. They had a whole plan. And I told him I'd never play him again. He did come back to me again and ask for a rematch. And I told him, I said, no, this is too important. It was about Title IX. It was about history. It was about hopefully getting the people to open their minds, hearts and minds to change,
right.
to change, to equality. It was all about everything for me is equality, equality, equality. Okay, that's all I care about for everyone. Because I grew up with a younger brother who played 12 years in Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
Randy Moffitt. Moffitt is our birth name. And we grew up in Long Beach, California, and we're public park kids.
Billie Jean King, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a blast talking with you. I appreciate it so much.
Thanks a lot. It was great talking with you. I look forward to seeing you. Come on out, everyone. Let's do this.
All right. Billie Jean King will be at the Keyholder 2017. For more information about that, sponsored by the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, go to WOSU.org/allsides. You've just been listening to Billie Jean King, and I appreciate you listening. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.